This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Alexis McLeod, and Sarah Tyson. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Justin Garson, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Hunter College, CUNY. His new book, What Biological Functions Are and Why They Matter, is just out from Cambridge University Press. Why do zebras have stripes? One way to answer that question is to ask what function stripes play in the lives of zebras, for example, to deter disease-carrying flies from biting them. This notion of a function plays a central role in biology. Biologists frequently refer to the functions of many traits of evolved organisms. But not everything a trait causes is its function. The stripes, for example, might disorient some harmless birds, but that isn't their function. So what determines the function of a trait? And what sorts of explanations are offered when biologists claim that a trait has a particular function? In his new book, Garson defends what he calls a generalized selected effects theory of what functions are and what they do. He argues that functions can result from differential retention as well as differential replication in a population. And he says that calling a trait a function is to provide a condensed causal explanation. He provides an accessible introduction to debates regarding functions in the philosophy of biology, as well as applications of his theory to contemporary debates in philosophy of psychiatry and the philosophy of mind. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Justin.
Hi,
Garson. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm looking forward to talking about your new book, What Biological Functions Are and Why They Matter. But before we get into the book itself, it's always nice to have a little bit of background about you, right? Can you say about, you know, who you are and how you got interested in philosophy, and then how you came to write
this book?
Sure,
absolutely. Let's see, about how I got interested in philosophy. As an undergraduate, I was at a pretty conventional school for a while in the UNC system, and I was interested in so many things, in philosophy and psychology and literature and anthropology, and I was terrified by the idea that I was soon going to have to declare a major. It just seemed like the worst thing that could happen. And so I ended up fleeing across the country. I ended up going to a small liberal arts school out in Washington State called the Evergreen State College. It's a really great school. It was a great school for me, a lot of academic freedom. But one of the best things for me is that you didn't actually have to declare a major. So you could just take what you wanted, and then you get out with your BA in liberal arts. So that's what I did. And then I finished school, and I was out for a couple of years. I think I was waiting tables. And I thought, well, this is awful. I need to be back in school. I need to figure out what kind of job I can do where I can stay in school forever, and I can study pretty much whatever I want. And then it was obvious, well, you got to be a philosophy professor. And so that's how that's how that worked out. I love this job. I just feel grateful every day that I get to actually do this for a living. So about biological functions, kind of a weird topic, but when I was in graduate school, I was very interested in philosophical aspects of psychiatry and this whole question of what is a mental illness. So suppose that the psychiatrists are arguing with one another about whether or not such and such is a mental illness, is, gender identity disorder. Is that a real mental illness, or alcoholism, or Asperger's, or I think the newest one is premenstrual dysphoric disorder. They argue with one another, and you think, you know, it'd be nice if they had some clear rules or some clear guidelines to help them decide what is and what is not a mental illness. And when I talked to some psychiatrists, I talked to a few philosophers, and one very prominent idea out there is that what distinguishes mental disorders from any other kind of maybe socially disvalued condition is that when somebody has a mental disorder, it's because there's some kind of a dysfunction inside of them, some kind of a dysfunction inside of their mind, inside of their brain that causes these thoughts, desires, feelings, these behaviors. And I thought, well, that sounds like a pretty good starting point, but now that raises an obvious question. What are functions and what are dysfunctions? And in a sense, who gets to decide whose brain is functioning well and who gets to decide whose brain is functioning poorly? And I thought about it like this. I like to think that my brain functions pretty well, but that maybe somebody with, delusions and hallucinations associated with schizophrenia, well, his brain is not functioning so well. But could he say with equal justice, no, Justin, you got it all wrong. In fact, it's my brain that's functioning well. My brain is functioning as it ought to. Your brain isn't functioning well. Would one of us be right? Some philosophers, I don't agree with them on this, but some philosophers thinking about this have gone so far as to think that, you know, all this talk about function and dysfunction and functioning well and functioning poorly, isn't this just a screen for our own value judgments? Finally occurred to me that I wasn't going to make any progress in philosophy of psychiatry or the question of what is a mental disorder until I got clear in my own mind about biological functions. And once I discovered that there was a number of philosophers who were also fascinated with this whole question of biological function, that just seemed like the natural place to go. That I thought, well, this is the community of people that I really want to engage with. Though I always planned, and I still do plan on eventually coming back around to this topic of mental illness.
Okay, so that's. Boy, there's a number of questions that arising from that answer, including the basic relationship between the biological function and, of course, the mm-hmm. mental function. I will set that aside.
Because
I want to get to what you actually discuss in the talk, taking for granted, you know, sort of what sort of relationship there is. There are two basic approaches, more or less, to the nature of biological functions, one of which is generally a selected effects theory, and the other is a causal role theory. I'm probably simplifying a little bit, but those are certainly two prominent ways to think about biological functions. And you give what you call generalized selected effects theory. So maybe you could start us off by explaining what these two main or dominant approaches are, and then how your theory differs from sort of the how it falls within the camp of the selected effects.
Approach. Absolutely. Okay. Wow. Let's see. Well, I would even start before getting into the selected effects theory and the causal role theory. It might be useful just to take a minute to lay out the basic problem context that's motivating these different theories. But I think philosophers, since the 1950s and 1960s, have seen a couple very basic puzzles about the ordinary biological use of function. And I should just say, when I write about biological functions, I decided, okay, the best thing for me to do is to forget about controversial function assignments, forget about things like psychiatry and mental illness, and just focus in on basic biology. The function of the heart is to beat. What do they mean by that? The function of the liver is to detoxify the blood. Or there's one that's becoming my personal favorite, which is the function of zebra stripes. And when I was writing this book, I wanted to have a nice example of something that wasn't totally obvious and kind of interesting. So I thought, okay, I wonder what biologists think the zebra stripes function is. And what I discovered is that they have no idea, that they've actually been arguing about precisely this issue for centuries. And some biologists think that the function of the zebra stripes is camouflage. Some of them think it has to do with thermoregulation, with cooling. But there's this more recent idea, and I'll use this as my canonical function statement. There's this more recent theory that the function of the zebra stripes is to ward off biting flies. This is a biologist out in California, Tim Caro, points out that in Central Africa, there's a whole genus of biting flies called tsetse flies. And they carry a parasite that's responsible for sleeping sickness, which can be fatal to these animals. And for some weird reason, there's some lab evidence, there's some field evidence, that these tsetse flies don't like landing on striped things. You can put a white cloth down, they'll land on it. You could put a black cloth down, they'll land on it. If you put a striped cloth down, they don't land on it as frequently. They don't seem to know what to do with it. I don't know why that is. Maybe they don't recognize it as a.
Is that an optical illusion for them?
I have no clue. I don't know. I'm fascinated. I mean, that's a great question. Okay. Is it that they don't see it as a surface? Is it that there's something about stripes that they just have an aversion to? I don't know why that's true. But there's a lot of interesting evidence for this somewhat newish idea that the function of the zebra stripes is to deter these biting flies. So using that as the canonical example, there are a couple basic puzzles that I think philosophers have really been preoccupied with the functions debate. And the first, of course, is that not every effect of a trait is its function. We seem to, of all the different effects that a trait produces, we seem to pick out one or maybe a very few, and it's like we put those on a pedestal and we say, well, this is the function of the trait. So the heart pumps blood. It also makes beating sounds that you can listen to through a stethoscope. But of course, we say, well, it's the pumping blood. That's the function. It's not making beating sounds. So that's really the first puzzle. Why do we pick out one specific effect? What's the principle that leads us to pick out this one effect rather than some other effect as the trait's function. Another puzzle is this issue of dysfunction or malfunction. A trait that has a function can typically malfunction or become dysfunctional. So if I, morbid example, but if my heart seizes up, if I go into a cardiac arrest, we generally wouldn't say that my heart doesn't have a function anymore. We would say, no, it's a heart. It does have the function of pumping blood. It just can't perform that function. It's dysfunctional or it's malfunctioning. But here's the third and the last big puzzle, and this is the one that I really get hung up on, which is that sometimes, at least when biologists attribute functions to traits, they seem to be trying to explain why the trait exists. So when Tim Caro wrote a paper called The Function of Zebra Stripes, it was clear from the context that he was trying to explain why zebras have stripes. How did the zebra come to get its stripes? There's some kind of a causal or historical dimension to function statements. I don't know if function statements are always used in this causal explanatory way, but at least sometimes that seems to be the gist of a function statement. When we say that the function of the zebra stripes is to deter biting flies, it seems that we're trying to explain why zebras have stripes. And that's a puzzle that a lot of philosophers have noticed. How is it that the effect of the trait, deterring flies, explains the existence of that very trait? So all that's just by way of setting up the basic problem context. Now, in that context, and I hope I'm going to be fair to both sides here, despite the fact that I do have a little bit of favoritism. In the 1980s, you had two different people independently of one another come up with the selected effects theory of function. That was Karen Neander and Ruth Millikan. And both of them said that the function of a trait is whatever it was selected for by natural selection. Some people don't like this phrase, but I'll say it anyway. You could say the function of the trait is whatever natural selection designed it for, whatever natural selection put it there for. And I think the real beauty of the it's a very simple point of view. I mean, there are some bells and whistles, but it's a pretty simple view. And I think the beauty of the view is that it resolves all of these puzzles about function in a very simple and elegant way. So the first one, not every effect of a trait is its function. Why do we pick out one effect or a handful of effects and call those the trait's function? Well, the reason that we say that pumping blood is the function of the heart, not making beating sounds, is that that's what natural selection designed it for. That's why natural selection favored hearts. Similarly, if we want to explain malfunctioning or dysfunction, at least conceptually, it's very easy to understand. That's because whether or not a trait, take a heart, whether or not a trait has a function depends entirely on its history. It depends entirely on how evolution unfolded. Whether or not the trait can perform the function here and now, of course, depends on its inner mechanism, on its environment. So at least conceptually, it's easy to understand how a trait can have a function due to its history that it's unable to perform. And one consequence of that is that I think statements about dysfunction are actually very objective scientific statements. They're as objective as stating that something is an adaptation. And then finally, this to me was really the thing that convinced me, the thing that really made me a convert to the selected effects theory, is that it explains how it is that when we attribute a function to a trait, we are at the same time offering a causal explanation for why that trait exists. So we can think of it like this. When Tim Caro says that the function of the zebra stripes is to deter biting flies, according to the selected effects theory, what he's committed to is something like this, that at some time, in the past, there was a population of ancestors to modern zebras, and some of them had stripes, and some of them didn't have stripes. And the ones with the stripes, you know how this goes, were able to deter biting flies better than the ones without the stripes. And so the ones with the stripes persisted, stuck around in the population. And that's why zebras have stripes today. So quite literally, when I attribute a function to a trait, I'm offering an explanation, whether it be true or false, for why that trait exists. And it seems to me, and this is perhaps where my favoritism comes in, that no other theory of function really captures this kind of explanatory dimension of function statement. So that's why I'm really sold on it. But let me just say something about the causal role view that you mentioned, just to contrast it with the selected effects theory. So this is mainly due to Robert Cummins. And 1975, he wrote a paper called Functional Analysis. And he says, near the beginning of the paper, he admits that some biologists, when they attribute functions to traits, they seem to think that they are trying to explain the existence of that very trait. But he says that doesn't make any sense. There's no coherent theory of functions that would allow function statements to work in this way as causal explanations. So he urged that we take a very different approach. And so for Cummins and for this causal role theory, the function of a trait just consists in the contribution that it makes to some higher level system capacity that we happen to be interested in. So it's very much relative to our own interests, to our own perspective. So in his opinion, the reason we can justifiably say the function of the heart is to circulate blood is because, or the function of the heart is to beat. And that's because the beating contributes to some higher level system capacity, namely the circulating blood. And that's what we're interested in. We're not, in his view, trying to explain the existence of the heart. We're not trying to explain why it's there. And one problem with his view, and again, I'm not going to harp on what's wrong with his view, but I'll just one famous issue with his view is that in some ways it seems to be overly liberal in the way that it gives out functions. So suppose I happen to be interested in the way that the body makes different kinds of sounds, then given my interests and given my perspectives, it would make perfect sense. I would be justified in saying that the function of the heart is to make a certain thumping sound because that's how the heart contributes to the sounds that the body makes in general. So a lot of people have pointed out that it makes functions very perspectival. Some people think that's problematic, but Cummins and his followers don't think that's problematic. It's just a consequence of his view.
Right. Well, okay. So you are going to give, or you do give a what you call the generalized selected effects. So how does your version of it go?
Good. Thanks. That was the second part of your question. So here's a problem with the selected effects theory. If Cummins' causal role theory seems too general, too liberal, people have argued that the selected effects theory is too narrow. It excludes too many things from having functions that intuitively and even according to biological usage do have functions. So it makes sense of functions when we're thinking about evolutionary timescales, the function of the heart, the function of the zebra stripes. But of course, psychologists often make function statements that seem to have nothing to do with natural selection. So you might say something like, I don't know, the function of the rats pressing the lever The function of the rat's lever-pressing behavior is to get some food. That seems like a perfectly sensible, legitimate function statement, but it's not. There's not like a mechanism in the rat's brain that was designed by natural selection to push a lever when it's hungry. Similarly, in neuroscience, as I'm sure you're very aware, it seems that neuroscientists are perfectly comfortable attributing functions to parts of the brain that most likely did not evolve by natural selection. So when I've read about reading ability, some people say, well, there's this area in our brain, what is it, the fusiform gyrus, and that one of its functions is to help us, say a native English speaker, help us determine what sequence of letters constitutes a potentially genuine word and which sequences of letters are nonsensical. And it seems to me that neuroscientists generally would be comfortable attributing functions to parts of the brain in terms of how they contribute to reading ability. But if reading ability wasn't shaped by natural selection, then it seems that the selected effects theory couldn't say anything about that. So that's one issue. So a handful of people, and I'm kind of in this minority tradition, Ruth Milliken pointed this out, Paul Griffiths, David Papineau, a few people said, maybe we can extend the basic idea of the selected effects theory to cover other kinds of processes other than evolutionary natural selection. And one of the examples that was sometimes used is something like trial and error behavior or operant conditioning. You say you have a hungry rat, and there's a cage, and there's a lever, and it gets hungry, and maybe it tries doing things somewhat randomly. It maybe scratches at the door or tries to climb out of the cage. Nothing works. It presses the lever. It gets food, and so that behavior is reinforced, and it keeps doing that. And one of the things that Milliken David Papineau suggested is that we should think of this as a kind of selection process that gives rise to new functions. It doesn't give rise to new functions, of course, in an evolutionary scale, but on the scale of development, because they thought it's similar enough to natural selection. You have a group of behavior dispositions. Some of those are reinforced over others because of their effects, and therefore they come to have functions. And that seems like fundamentally the right way to go to me, is to expand the notion of selection to capture other kinds of functions, the kinds of functions that we have sometimes in psychology or in neuroscience. But it seemed to me that, first of all, these philosophers never developed the suggestion in a very systematic way. And secondly, it seemed to me that that suggestion actually contradicted the basic premises of their theories of function. So Ruth Milliken is a good example, but pretty much everybody else did the same thing, and sometimes very explicitly and very heartily. They would restrict functions to entities that undergo something like reproduction or copying. And of course, the paradigm is an organism that reproduces itself. So they thought that, okay, in order for behaviors generated by trial and error to have new functions, we have to find something akin to reproduction or copying. I know, we'll say that a certain behavior, say my pressing the lever, is the thing that's getting reproduced. So maybe my pressing the lever on a Tuesday, say I press the lever on a Tuesday and it works out for me, I get some food. So I press the lever on a Wednesday, it works out, I get some food. I press the lever on a Thursday. Maybe we should say that each instance of the lever pressing is kind of like a reproduction or a copy of the instance of lever pressing that preceded. That was the basic pattern that they tried to use. Now, it seems to me that that's at least, maybe it's not wrong, but it seems at least a stretch to think of behavior tokens as forming something like parent-offspring relations or being copies of one another. It seems to me that the notion of reproduction is out of place. At least a more natural way of describing what's going on is to say that you have these different behavioral dispositions. Some of them, like the lever-pressing disposition, are getting strengthened. And some of them, like the disposition to scratch at the door, are getting weakened. You don't have to try to fit what's going on into this pattern of reproduction or copying. It seems more natural to say that certain things, namely these behavior patterns, are simply persisting better, longer, more efficiently than others. And so that was the basic idea. Let me just say, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Finish
okay.
up and then I'll...
One other thing, if I realize some people don't find the thing about trial and error behavior that they say, well, why not describe that as a form of reproduction or copying?
Right. I mean, that was essentially, I was going to say, you know, I mean, you seem to have restricted reproduction to parent offspring. Mm-hmm. And the obvious move is to say, well, what justifies that restriction? I mean, the idea is that something gets replicated in some sense. The behavior, you know, it's just one, and then it becomes, you know, a type of behavior. Mm-hmm. Or the first one was an instance of the type, however you want to mm-hmm. say it. The response is just, you know, what justifies restricting the term reproduction or replication to just parent offspring when there are perfectly respectable, it seems, relationships that apply to both, you know, behavior
yeah.
tokens as well as other sorts of traits, because, you know, biologists do call behavior traits. Aren't you
right.
the one who's being a little bit too, you know, defining things the way you want?
Right. I understand that. And so let me give a different kind of example than the trial and error. The trial and error one was just to start warming up your intuitions,
yeah.
but it was not meant to be the knockdown kind of argument. And the fact that one way of talking seems more natural to me, so who cares what seems more natural to you? Here's another example that I think is even better and that occurred to me was the example of neural selection. Neural selection takes place when – I don't know how common it is or how rare it is. There's still some disagreement in my understanding about how common or rare neural selection is. But neural selection takes place when there's some kind of a competitive relationship between neural elements, whether they be synapses or whole neurons or even potentially whole groups of neurons. So just use the simplest possible case of synapse selection. Suppose you have two neurons and both of them synapse onto the same target neuron. And suppose one of those synapses has some useful downstream effect. Synapse A and synapse B. Synapse A is good. It has some useful downstream effect. Synapse B does not have a useful downstream effect. One possibility is that synapse A is going to be retained and synapse B is going to be eliminated. This kind of thing happens in the neuromuscular junction. It's part of my understanding. It's part of the formation of these abnormal ocular dominance columns. But the point is that it seems to me that that should be sufficient for giving rise to a new function. If one synapse is retained because of some useful effect and another synapse is eliminated, it seems to me that that should be enough. And it doesn't just seem to me that that should be enough. It seems to me that you could argue on the basis of the first principles, if you will, that anybody who accepts the selected effects theory of function, which restricts functions to entities that undergo something like reproduction or differential reproduction, should also, for the same reasons, accept this more general point of view, where I can give functions to things not merely because they undergo something like differential reproduction, but also because they undergo something like differential persistence. And I think that when you broaden functions to include differential persistence, you suddenly have a much more natural way of explaining functions, not only in this evolutionary framework, but at least some functions in psychology and some functions in neuroscience. And I think that's a real game changer in some ways. I think it really changes the conversation, and I think it has a lot of interesting implications for other debates and disputes.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, so just to be clear, I mean, where say Milliken or and Papineau Griffiths might say that the behavior reproduces or replicates, you would just say, well, no, it differential, there's differential persistence.
Yeah, I would say
is that
that's
correct?
Right. So let me see my theory. I have my book here, so I have to remember exactly what I said. So the generalized selected effects theory says that a function of a trait is an activity that contributed in the past either to that trait's differential reproduction, as in evolutionary natural selection, or to that trait's differential retention, as in synapse selection, maybe trial and error learning in a population. So it's a disjunctive approach to function where it just I accept all of the functions that the traditional selected effects theorist accepts, the theorist that restricts functions to things that undergo differential reproduction, but I include that to encompass many other sorts of functions, the ones that just involve something like differential persistence. There still has to be some kind of a competitive element, but it can take place between things that don't, strictly speaking, reproduce.
Right. And so for you, the reproduction part is a historical, evolutionary historical property.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think that the reason, I mean, it's complicated because there are a few reasons that some people have actually been, it wasn't just a slip or an accident that they restricted functions to things that undergo differential reproduction rather than just persistence. Uh-huh. Some people have argued this very explicitly, that functions require reproduction. Ruth Milliken, in her 1993 book, The White Queen Psychology, there's a point where she says, if you don't restrict functions to things that undergo some kind of reproduction or copying, you're going to have a view that's so liberal, it's going to be totally out of touch with the way that biologists actually speak. And Peter Godfrey Smith makes a similar remark in a 1993 paper. He says very explicitly, we've got to restrict functions to things that undergo something like reproduction or copying, or else we won't be able to stave off all kinds of absurd counterexamples. So a big part of the book is explaining how you can make this move. You can broaden functions to include all of these other kinds of domains like neuroscience and psychology, and you don't succumb to all kinds of absurd or trivializing counterexamples.
Okay, good. So you also so the selection here is at the population level, right? I mean, there's sort of three elements to your generalization: the differential reproduction, differential retention or persistence in some way, and then population. Could you explain that aspect? Because and in particular, because you say that, you know, to ascribe a function to some trait is to give a condensed causal explanation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and selection over natural selection anyway, over evolutionary timescales, mm-hmm. is defined over populations, not mm-hmm. individuals. And so, you know, there seems to be there needs to be some sort of clarification as to the sense in which natural selection, functions defined at the population level mm-hmm. are causal mm. explanations as opposed to just in some way causally relevant. I mean, I take it this is one of Cummins, you know, the causal mm-hmm. role points is, you know, you want on their view, you want to say what is being contributed by a particular mm-hmm. trait to the current operations of the organism. Mm-hmm. And that's a very clear right. sort of causal relationship mm-hmm. there. But once you start talking about populations, it's more difficult, yeah. right, to see how function talk at this in terms of select effects are going to provide what you call condensed causal explanations. Yeah. Oh. So could you say something about the population level, feature of your theory, and then how these descriptions provide causal explanations?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question. So there are really two parts, I take it. And one part is easy and one part is hard. One part, I think I can give a pretty good answer. And the other part, I probably will not give a very good answer, maybe not a very satisfying answer. But let me say why I add that in my definition of function. A function of a trait is an activity that contributed to that trait's differential reproduction as in evolutionary natural selection, or differential reproduction as in, say, neural selection, in a population. That was very important because several people brought to my attention that expanding functions in the way that I do to include not only differential reproduction, but also differential persistence could have all kinds of terrible consequences. It would be overly liberal in precisely the way that I accuse people like Cummins of being overly liberal. And here is one example, Justine Kingsbury wrote a paper where she mentions this just as an aside, but I thought it was a good point. She said, suppose you expand functions to include, restrict functions to reproduction, but you expand functions to include something like persistence. Okay, now imagine you have just a bunch of rocks scattered on a beach, and some of those rocks are going to be harder than others. And the harder ones will presumably withstand erosion better than the softer ones. And so over time, you're just going to – the harder ones are going to remain. It seems like that would be a case of differential persistence. But it seems absurd to say that the function of hardness is a function of rocks. And so that's why she says, look, you've got, and this was the theme, Millikan and Godfrey Smith made comments in the similar kind of direction. That's why you have to restrict functions to things that undergo reproduction, or else you're going to get these bizarre counterexamples. And it seemed to me that another way, and I agree that that's a serious counterexample, and I agree that it's good for a theory of biological function to hang together pretty well with the way that biologists use the term function, and so I agree that that would be a problem. But it seems to me that another way you could avoid the example is by restricting functions to members of a population. And of course, and I want to say, well, a bunch of rocks on the beach, that's not a population. That's just an aggregate or a collection. So, of course, the next question would be, well, what exactly is a population? And it's a good question. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not a question that philosophers of biology have spent a lot of time thinking about up until recently. So in 2009, you had some work by Roberta Milstein and Peter Godfrey Smith, really pointing to the importance and the centrality of this notion of a biological population. But one of the themes that runs throughout this somewhat sparse literature is that in order for a bunch of individuals to constitute a population, they have to interact with one another in the right way. There has to be something like fitness-relevant interactions between them. My behavior has to have some impact on your fitness. Your behavior has to have some impact on my fitness, or my behavior has to have some impact on some third party whose behavior has some impact on your fitness, that kind of thing. And so it seemed to me that this was a really good way of avoiding those kinds of trivializing counterexamples. Even with this very minimal conception of what a population is, I think we can say that a bunch of rocks on the beach, that's not a population, because there's nothing analogous to fitness-relevant interactions. It's not as if the rate at which one rock erodes has some impact on the rate at which other rocks erode. So I think that if you demand that there be some kind of a interaction between these entities, some kind of a fitness-relevant or persistent-relevant interaction, you can avoid a lot of those trivializing counterexamples. And people have come up with other counterexamples that are somewhat more sophisticated, but I think that if we really dig into this notion of a population and explicate it sufficiently, we can avoid the worst of them. So that's why I say that. Now, let's see your other part, and this is the part that I don't think I'll have anything really satisfying to say. Let's see. So the question is, what makes natural selection a cause? Is that right? So it's easy to think that maybe, yeah, you know, I push a rock, it rolls down the hill, I'm the cause of the rock, and philosophers have disagreed with one another about whether natural selection operating at the population level can be a cause. I mean, it's easy to think that, okay, an animal dying, an animal surviving, two animals fighting over food, those kinds of things are singular events. They can have causal impacts, but natural selection, I take it that this is where you're coming from, that some people have said that it's just not the right kind of thing to be a cause, or it's not a cause in some proper sense of the term.
Right. They're statistical, you know, sort of. They're you know, it's like the statistics, you know, the population, the percentage of, say, zebras that have stripes, mm-hmm, increases, you know, as a percentage of the population over the zebras that don't have stripes, right? Mm-hmm. That because of because the ones with stripes survive to reproduce more than the ones with that don't have stripes or have worse, mm-hmm, stripes or, mm-hmm, something. But that's just a, you know, basically a statistical, you know, measure over percentages of a population. Mm-hmm. And so if function talk is, you know, is defined in terms of an explanation, you know, historical explanation for why you have a particular trait, mm-hmm, that it's a perfectly fine historical explanation, but the question is just, you call them condensed causal explanation.
Exactly. I understand. And this is where, I mean, I'm going to admit my knowledge of the causation literature kind of starts to tap out here when we get to these kinds, okay, of questions. But just two things I'll say, and again, I don't, these are not particularly sophisticated things to say. One point I would make is that, I mean, if the issue is a micro and macro kind of issue, so we can describe, when we say that natural selection explains why most zebras today have stripes, mm-hmm, The fact that we can tell that story at a kind of micro level, individual level perspective doesn't rule out our ability to tell a causal story at the macro perspective. So, I'm thinking of two billiard balls. One billiard ball strikes another billiard ball. We typically think of that as a perfectly good causal explanation. Of course, we could restate the explanation at a kind of micro molecular level, but the fact that we can tell this causal story at the micro molecular level doesn't rule out that there's a legitimate causal story to be told at this more macro level too. So I wonder if that's not part of what's going on, that because we can see a nice cause and effect story at the level of individuals and singular events, maybe we think that that somehow excludes our being able to give a cause and effect story kind of at the macro level. I don't know. That's just the one thing I would say. Here's the other thing that I would say. My understanding of the causation literature is that there's two main perspectives. There's two main theories on what causes are. And one theory emphasizes this idea that causes should mainly be thought of at this individual level as a relationship between singular events. So I throw a rock, mm-hmm. It smashes a window. Somehow causation seems to consist in the fact that there's been some kind of a transfer of energy from the rock to the window. And I absolutely agree. If that's what causation is, then it doesn't seem like natural selection is a proper cause. It's more like, as you said, a statistical summary of a bunch of lower level events. The other notion of cause, however, in my understanding, is a little bit more perhaps inclusive in what it would consider a cause. It's this difference-making account. So something like this, mm-hmm. I strike a match, it causes a fire. What we mean by that the striking the match causes the flame, is that if I hadn't struck the match, and other things being equal, had I not struck the match, there wouldn't be a flame. And we can think about this getting into possible worlds. I think the idea would be something like this. On the nearest possible world where I did not strike that match, there would not be a flame. And my sense, or this is what I suspect, that perhaps this difference-making approach to cause might be more inclusive in terms mm-hmm. of what we consider to be a proper cause and effect story. So natural selection would be a cause in this particular way. On a nearby possible world where stripes do not deter tsetse flies, zebras would not have stripes. I think that the difference-making perspective would consider that, if that's true, then they would consider it valid to say that the fact that stripes deter tsetse flies is a causal explanation for why most zebras have stripes. But that's all I have to say on that. But I don't know. We're getting beyond my pay scale, as they say, once we get into deeper metaphysics. But
okay. Well, that's fine.
I had this other thing. I'll just say this. I had some of the reviewers for my book, I first said that functions are typically restricted to parts of organisms rather than whole organisms. So we say that the zebra stripes mm. have a function, but we don't say zebras have a function. And immediately they had a very good question. What do you mean by a part? And what exactly is the relationship between a part and a whole? And I thought, oh no, I've gotten into deep trouble now by bringing in this stuff about parts and wholes. So I managed to say something different that didn't raise the same flags. But it's kind of an awkward situation when you're trying to skirt some of these bigger metaphysical issues about the nature of parts and wholes or the nature of causation.
Right. Well, these are difficult problems for everybody, mm-hmm. I think. So let me get to some of the applications, yeah. Right? And in particular, I mean, you started your own personal sort of motivation came from, you know, philosophy of psychiatry and definitions of mental disorder, dysfunction. And one of the chapters, you know, towards the end, when you talk about, you know, applications of your theory, one of those primary applications, of course, is to the philosophy of psychiatry and determining what are mental disorders mm-hmm. or dysfunctions mm-hmm. and what are not. And as you also mentioned, you know, there's a whole stream of thought here. You know, at least one important part of this debate is the idea that what people will call a function or dysfunction is a highly relative, you know, interest relative, culture mm-hmm. relative, you know, society relative matter. And a frequent case here used is the fact that I forget which DSM 4-3 whatever classified homosexuality as uh-huh. as some sort of a disorder, right? I mean, that's kind of the classic right. case in this. But much more in nowadays, right? You've got the deaf community saying, you know, we're our own community, and there's nothing, you know, we don't have a dysfunction or anything. Mm-hmm. We're just, you know, different. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's simplifying, right. but that's right. the basic idea. So can you say a bit about your approach, you know, given your initial motivations, can you say a bit about your approach to the classification of mental disorders or dysfunctions and, you know, specifically how your theory helps or how it at least it provides some sort of an answer to these debates?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are both really good questions. I mean, one is that this one thing you raised closer to the end is that this notion of dysfunction can have a really strong negative association or connotation. We think saying something is a dysfunction sounds like, you know, if we say being deaf or hard of hearing stems from a dysfunction, it sounds like we're potentially saying, you know, people who are deaf are somehow defective, or that they're broken, or that they're deficient. There's something wrong with them when we ought to change them, which is a pretty awful thing to say. So the first thing that I would say about that is that my view of function and dysfunction, it is meant to be a naturalistic kind of approach. I do think that there is some, I don't know what the facts are, but I do think that there is a fact of the matter, as they say, about whether deafness or being hard of hearing, say, does stem from a dysfunction or doesn't stem from a dysfunction. But in my view, I try to separate as much as possible this question of whether something is functional and dysfunctional on the one hand from whether it is good, desirable, something that we should strive towards on the other. So for me, if it's true that, say, being deaf or hard of hearing stems from a dysfunction, that wouldn't imply anything, socially speaking. That wouldn't imply that it's somehow undesirable to have, or it's something that we ought to intervene on, or it's something that we ought to change. And it seems to me that some of the objections that people have raised regarding my notion of function and dysfunction stem from the fact that in their mind, saying that something is dysfunctional is just so closely connected to saying that it's undesirable, it's bad, it's something that society should stamp out or eliminate. And I certainly don't want to embrace any of those kinds of explicitly normative or political agendas. And then the second thing is this, about... And it drives me crazy when people throw around the dysfunction label in a very, I don't know, kind of lazy way. So maybe you turn on Dr. Phil. Not that you would watch Dr. Phil, but you turn something on like Dr. Phil, and maybe they're talking about somebody who's an exhibitionist, and they have a psychiatrist on, and the psychiatrist says, well, everybody knows that the exhibitionist, that comes from a brain dysfunction. I hate that stuff. I hate when the notion of function and dysfunction is thrown around in this very loose, casual way. But here's where I think the biggest payoff for my view is when it comes to thinking about mental illness and mental disorder. The view that I'm really opposed to is this idea that in order for something to be a mental disorder, there has to be some kind of underlying dysfunction. And I the philosopher that I really have used many times as a foil for my writing is Jerome Wakefield. Wakefield has, he calls it the harmful dysfunction analysis of disorder. And in his point of view, in order for something to be a legitimate mental disorder, it has to stem from some kind of a dysfunction. Now, he and I are in agreement about one thing, namely that functions are selected effects. He accepts the selected effects theory of function, as I do. So he restricts functions to selection in this in the sense of evolutionary natural selection. So in his view, quite literally, in order for something to be a mental disorder, there has to be some kind of a mechanism inside the person that fails to perform its evolved functions. Mental disorders are evolved dysfunctions. And that just seems like far too narrow a way of thinking about mental illness. One of the criticisms that people have often raised against Wakefield is what sometimes called the mismatch objection. I didn't come up with this. I wish I had, because I think it's so clever. And the question is, why are you so confident that mental disorders always or generally stem from dysfunctions? Isn't it possible, evolutionarily speaking, that at least some mental disorders are adaptations? They perhaps benefited some of our ancestors long ago, perhaps in the Pleistocene era, and they exist now precisely because they had that benefit. So, I mean, we're getting pretty speculative here, but take something like generalized anxiety disorder. Isn't it at least logically conceivable that those among our Pleistocene ancestors who were susceptible to what we would now call generalized anxiety disorder were more vigilant to potential threats in their environment and perhaps survived a little bit better than those who were not susceptible to anxiety disorders? There's plenty of psychologists who have speculated about the evolution of depression. Isn't it possible that depression might have served some kind of a purpose or a function amongst our ancestors, and that's why it exists today? Perhaps depression has the function of helping us to let go of unrealistic life goals or things like that. So it seems to me that Wakefield is mistaken by insisting that mental disorders have to stem from biological dysfunctions. Now, here's how my view contributes to that kind of debate, because on my view, on this generalized selected effects theory, it seems even more likely that what we think of as a mental disorder might actually be an adaptation. It might actually serve some function. And that's because I recognize many more function bestowing. In my view, there are many more ways that something can acquire a function than on the traditional selected effects theory. So I'll just give a simple example to convey the point, probably overly simplistic. But suppose you have like a young boy who grows up in a very abusive household. And suppose he acquires certain psychological behavioral dispositions that are consistent with that. He becomes hostile. He becomes susceptible to violent outbursts. Maybe he uses a broken bottle in a fight. He has the kinds of symptoms that psychiatrists would classify as conduct disorder. But it seems to me that it's at least possible for some people and in some situations that those dispositions, that those psychological, those behavioral dispositions actually developed because they served, because they had a purpose, because they served some kinds of function, because there are ways for the kid to say, you know, keep your distance from me, you know, stay within 10 feet of me and don't come near me again. And if that's right, then according to my view, this generalized selected effects theory, then those kinds of dispositions would have a function. They wouldn't be dysfunctional at all. So I think my view advances that conversation by suggesting, look, this idea that there are mental disorders that are functional and adaptive or that have a function, this is an idea that we need to take very, very seriously. We shouldn't just assume as a matter of course that mental disorders generally involve dysfunctions.
Okay, very good. So we are actually out of time.
Wow.
So it's been a great conversation. And there's plenty more to talk about, but unfortunately, we won't get to, but I would encourage listeners to, you know, actually pick up the book. So just to close for, you know, very briefly, what's on the horizon for you? Are you doing follow-up work or, wow. You know, again, this is just a quick
I get it. I'll try to stay within 2 minutes, but I promise. I'm on sabbatical now. I'm very fortunate. So I'm on sabbatical until next September. And I'm actually working on that follow-up book about mental illness and philosophy of psychiatry. And what I'm doing is actually exploring historically the historical manifestations in psychiatry of this idea that some mental disorders may have some kind of a purpose or some kind of a function or maybe adaptations. It seems to me that this is actually an idea that is expressed in different ways throughout the history of psychiatry. I mean, going back hundreds of years to people like Richard Burton in his Anatomy of Melancholy, he thought mental disorders generally were punishments from God. There are ways that God both punishes us, but also offers us redemption. And it's a silly idea. It's not an idea that I take seriously. What I find fascinating, though, is that for hundreds of years, psychiatrists have been at least aware of and sensitive to this idea that a lot of the things that we think of as mental illnesses might have some kind of a purpose or a function or adaptive value that we've overlooked. So it's a historical book that tries to explicate, to trace out that way of thinking through psychiatry's history. And I hope that my goal in doing that is that when you see kind of historically how many people have adopted this view that mental disorders have some kind of a functional or adaptive or purposeful significance, then that will really start to change our perspective. And it'll make us less likely to just assume as a matter of course that mental disorders must involve some kind of a dysfunction.
Okay, very good. Well, I wish you luck with that and
thank you.
And have a great sabbatical.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Anyway, so we should go. But thank you again for taking the time to talk on New Books in Philosophy.
All right. Thank you, Carrie.
Okay, bye-bye. You've been listening to my interview with Justin Garson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Hunter College, City University of New York. His new book, What Biological Functions Are and Why They Matter, is just out from Cambridge University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.